Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, celebrating the election outcome in Canada with Professor Anthony Hall. He's a professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge. Let's hear it from Tony Hall. Let's call him up. Hello, Tony. How's it going?
Okay.
Congratulations on deposing your Zio-Nazi thug.
Yes, well, it's quite a transformation. Mind you, there's a certain uniformity with all the parties when it comes to sort of Israel, Palestine, Iran. But Trudeau is a congenial man, and he definitely embodies a lot more potential for a decent Canadian future than tyrannical international criminal Stephen Harper.
Well, you know, that's so good, Tony. Let's just go. This is the show now. I'm not even doing my conventional introduction because then I would have to erase that. And it was too good to erase. You're sending a message when somebody runs on, you know, neocon-style mega-Islamophobia like Harper did, and, you know, false flag terror like the Ottawa shooting. You know, somebody carries on that sort of 9/11 Ziocon legacy, and you beat him and you throw him out. I mean, that's good.
It was overwhelming, the trauma of seeing, you know, the decency of Canada just go down the tubes with this idea that Muslim hating, that building on this, you know, 14 years of planting poison in people's minds, that somehow Islam is a religion of violence and danger and psychopathy, you know, that this was the basis of the campaign of Stephen Harper. And he brought in from Australia Lytton Crosby, who helped Cameron win in UK, an expert in how you use hatred of one group towards another group to win elections, to get votes. And I have to say that Trudeau did step up to the plate at a very crucial time. And he said, for instance, you know, it wasn't just the niqab issue. There was an issue about Muslim headgear, women wearing masks at citizen ceremonies, a little issue, but it became very contentious. And it was connected to something called, get a load of this, it was actually called the Barbaric Cultural Practices Act, a snitch line that you would phone in if your neighbor is doing something that
barbaric
you consider
cultural
to be
practices.
Barbaric cultural practices. Yeah, and you know, all of this is sort of playing upon this meme that has been planted. I mean, it was a very clear expression of the implications of not dealing with 9/11 and just allowing, you know, false flag after false flag, just allowing neocon governments, you know, not only neocon governments, but that's where it's primarily coming from with Netanyahu and his invention in 1979 of this whole terrorist meme, just seeing that come to fruition. So I have to say, I guess there's a time limit here, but I want to get to the point that Justin Trudeau did pick this up. He identified this exploitation of fear in politics. And he, you know, very appropriately referenced Franklin Roosevelt's statement, you know, when he took power in the 30s to combat the Great Depression. And he said, you know, all we have to fear is fear itself. These words, you know, resonate through history.
Trudeau
pointed out that all Harper has to offer is fear. He is offering fear. And then Trudeau went through the different fears. And the first one he says is fear of terrorism. So it seems to me very appropriate now. And what I intend to do, and I asked for some help on this, is to, you know, put it to Justin Trudeau that now you have identified the exploitation of fear of Islamic terrorism. So we have to do a real investigation now to figure out, you know, how much of this fear might be legitimate, how much of this fear is concocted, how much of this fear is manufactured, how much of the events to create this fear are manufactured. Of course, you know, 9/11 is, now we know just one of them, because by not dealing with 9/11, it created the ground floor, you know, false flag after false flag. Your book, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, you know, points that out. You know, it's just overwhelming now how this meme of Muslim hating to get votes, to use as a vehicle to, you know, do surveillance, to empower police, to build up budgets. We have an entry now, I think, in Canada to insist that we have to have some investigation now to clarify, you know, what is true and what is false and what has been concocted. In other words, investigate 9/11 and all that came afterwards.
Well, that would be wonderful if Canada could set up that kind of commission. I'm a little skeptical about whether Trudeau is going to do that. I see Trudeau's election as having a lot in common with Obama's election in 2008. You know, the American people never really fully bought the neocon stuff, hook, line, and sinker. They actually voted Bush out in 2004. John Kerry won a landslide victory that was stolen through computer vote fraud. So then when Obama got an even bigger landslide, I guess the powers that be decided that it was time to let that happen. But Obama, of course, is a compromiser. He's a, you know, pretty face with who talks a good line, a smooth talker. He made, you know, makes Bush and Cheney look really bad by comparison. So a guy who's basically appealing personally was able to sort of put folks back to sleep and cover up the crimes of the 9/11 perps. And I see something like that as a likely outcome in Canada. I personally cannot imagine Trudeau setting up a commission on suspected false flag events, starting with Ottawa. That would be great, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a wink and a prayer. But, you know, it doesn't mean that we give up. We, you know, we look for whatever openings are available. And this is a new, a big change in Canada, a big change. And how can he justify that he's stood and created political mileage by standing up to this abuse of the terrorist threat and all the chicanery that goes with it without saying, well, now we've got to, you know, get to some sort of truth. Now, you know, get to some sort of veracity of, well, what does the evidence really show us about how what really happened and how has this been used and exploited by our political opponents? I will say with Obama that, you know, you couldn't really imagine at the time the election was taking place that brought Obama in a more major transition within the existing system from Bush to Obama. It seemed that this was the maximum that the system was able to deliver, to go from, you know, one type of policy to another type of policy. And it was hugely disappointing to people to see that he kept so many of the policies of Bush. And I'm sure, you know, there's going to be similar disappointment in Canada. And I think, you know, the Occupy movement of 2011 was very much a response that after you could see that the electoral system, can be betray people's hopes and the promise people feel and the hope and confidence they feel in a new government, and then seeing that betrayed and people being disappointed, that the Occupy movement was a very substantial proof that people were looking for other ways to transform the system, that the ballot box just isn't sufficient, that the lobbyists have taken over our governments to such an extent that we've lost our Congress and our legislatures and our parliaments. And these really aren't our governments. They belong to some other powers. And so certainly Trudeau is, you know, surrounded by all of that. And, you know, we see, for instance, during the invasion of Gaza, you know, that all the political parties kept to the same position that, you know, Israel was simply defending itself from, the Muslim threat, the terror threat, the Palestinian threat, that this was simply self-defense. And it was really pathetic to see, you know, how deeply conformist all the political parties were on that score, and how the media just won't allow really any real debate on these central issues of war and peace, life and death. And so liberals are caught up in that. Justin Trudeau voted for the horrific Bill C-51, the kind of Patriot Act plus, you know, after the Zaha Beppo Ottawa shooter event, the false flag event in Ottawa, and October 22nd, 2014. But nevertheless, you know, there are moments in history, and how much longer can this sort of escalating set of lies and just using the contamination of people's brains to make them fear Muslims generically? I mean, it becomes very clear that the disinformation connected to 9/11 amounts to hate speech. Our newspapers, our media, by not telling the truth and not dealing with the existing evidence of 9/11 and other false flag terrorist events that came since then, this amounts to promotion of hatred, promotion of discrimination, promotion of a mental environment that allows the military-industrial complex to kill people by the millions, to displace people by the millions. This is a Holocaust in our time. And this, we did see during this election this little niqab issue connected to this issue, the other issue in the Canadian newspapers during that election. All you would see in the big Zionist newspaper chain run by Paul Godfrey was, you know, pictures of Muslim people in different types of headgear and with different kinds of masks, with the word terrorism and homegrown terrorism, lone wolf terrorism, and you know the whole media system run by this diabolical Linton Crosby, this Australian who's an expert on this. This whole system was just, you know, going overtime to get Harper reelected with this Islamophobic agenda. And Trudeau did stand up to it. And now he has to be kind of held accountable and said, you know, now you've got to be consistent with how you got the mandate by standing up to this. You've got to, you know, put some analysis now. We've got to deal with some reality. It's just not good enough anymore to be, you know, putting out this constant poison, hate speech propaganda so neoconservative governments can keep power, so the war machine can keep, you know, murdering people. I mean, the Canadian government was caught recruiting for ISIL through the embassy in Jordan. There was very clear reports in March that the ambassador of, you know, Canada's ambassador in Jordan, who was Harper's former RCMP bodyguard, that the people around him were recruiting for ISIL. And it was reported, you know, in mainstream media, but just left there. So this whole ISIL psyop, and of course, you know, Putin so brilliantly intervening to actually start a real war on ISIL, and you know, as Iran has been doing, rather than this phony war from the United States, from the NATO countries against ISIL, where in fact ISIL is a psychological operation. Who funds it? Who organizes it? You know, it's classic case of this Middle East war amounting to the same parties backing both sides in the contest. So, you know, this old meme is getting too grotesque. You know, the idea that the war machine has its backers, people backing both sides in the contest, and it's kind of like a hedge fund. It doesn't, you know, matter which way it goes. You've got it covered.
They're trying to destroy and destabilize the region, so they don't really care who wins. It's like, who was it in the Reagan administration or the Bush administration talking about the Iran-Iraq war? They said, well, it's a pity that they can't both lose. And they just want they all want the whole Middle East to lose. They want the whole Middle East to be destroyed.
Yeah, and of course, you know, Canada and other countries have been selling weapons hand over fist to Saudi Arabia. And it came up in the election that this is going on, this is an issue. There's all these $15 billion in contracts, armored personnel carriers to Saudi Arabia. And then, interestingly, the NDP, the sort of supposedly more left party, you know, the labor unions that were involved in producing this weaponry got involved in pressuring the NDP not to make an issue of it.
Speaking of the NDP, let me get you there, Tony, because I got an email from Greg Felton, who is a former mainstream journalist in Vancouver, who kind of took the red pill, especially on the Zionism issue. And he's, of course, been de-mainstreamed and marginalized ever since. But Greg just sent out an email you know, saying from his perspective, he thinks it's too bad that it was Trudeau and the Liberals that threw out Harper rather than the NDP. He thinks the NDP would have been, you know, actually a force of real change, and he doesn't think the Liberals will be. And I'm sure there are some others who think that way. I met some of them while I was doing my Canada Charlie Hebdo tour this summer.
I saw Greg taking that position. One of the things that Tom Mulcair, the leader of the NDP party, that really got kind of decimated, they ended up with about 40 seats. Trudeau ended up with like 184 seats. The Conservatives ended up with 102 seats. And I saw Greg sort of bashing Trudeau and pushing NDP. But Mulcair, you know, his wife is Jewish, and he was very upfront about the fact that he's a Zionist, that he, you know, has a basically the policy of, you know, whatever Israel does, we won't really criticize them or not too directly. And he actually intervened in many ridings, constituencies, to withdraw NDP candidates who had said something positive about Palestinian rights on Facebook or something. So and that certainly was, you know, put Tom Mulcair's position in some kind of question for me, that he was you know, really doing a hardline Zionist effort in preparing who could run and who couldn't run for the NDP. And I'm surprised in a way that Greg seemed to think that, yes, you know, the Liberals, there was actually a Liberal candidate who was sort of forced to withdraw for having written something sensible about 9/11, Marie Manna, in 2013. Behind this all was Leslie Hughes. Leslie Hughes is about to bring out her book. She was forced to withdraw from the election in 2008, when it was discovered by a blogger in Winnipeg that Leslie Hughes, the Liberal candidate, had written something sensible about 9/11 in 2002. So, you know, we've had a history of the Liberal Party and the NDP withdrawing candidates, and the Liberal Party withdrawing candidates specifically because of things they wrote about 9/11. Actually, NDP was, you know, Bev Collins was going to be withdrawn, and then Jack Layton and Barry Vicker got together and sort of prevented Bev Collins in the 2008 election from being pulled out. So this is getting outrageous. Elizabeth May, the Green Party leader, she, you know, read a petition into Hansard in the parliament that there should be an investigation into 9/11. Then she said, "No, I don't agree with what the petition said." And then when we kind of pressured her, "Well, why? Just tell us why." "Fine, you don't agree. That's fine, but at least dignify the discussion with you know, why you don't agree." So the Green Party, the Liberal Party, the NDP Party, I mean, they're very, very subject to this pressure, especially focused in the Zionist media that won't let them, you know, discuss Israel, Palestine, Iran really clearly, won't let them discuss false flag terrorism, 9/11, and the reality that, you know, we in Canada should not be accepting the 9/11 Commission report in the United States as the basis for Canadian public policy. And not only that, that 9/11 Commission report, as we know, a lot of the key evidence is obtained through the use of torture. So there is Elizabeth May, for instance, you know, making Canadian public policy in the parliament or participating in the process based on information obtained through torture, through illegal torture. Therefore, you know, many of our parliamentarians are already complicit in illegal torture done, you know, by the United States in their various torture chambers and such, like on Guantanamo Bay. So, and then, you know, we have the Canadian Omar Khadr, who Harper let stay in the gulag of Guantanamo.
Yeah, he was just a teenager when he was arrested, and
his was
crime
a child
was what?
Soldier. He was
defending himself.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Know, all he did was defend himself, right?
Think. Yeah, well, he was 15 years old, so he was a child soldier, so there's all these UN treaties and conventions that say, look, you can't persecute child soldiers. They are the victims. You know, they aren't to be held as belligerents in a military context. And anyway, you know, he was in a war situation, and people were Americans were in a, far from their home base, in an aggressive warfare stance, and he was, had some indigenous roots in the area, and so he got involved in some kind of military situation.
Defending a group of people who were being attacked by aggressive warfare. Aggression is the number one war crime, according to Nuremberg. And so here's Omar Khadr decides to join the people he's living with in Afghanistan to defend himself and them against a brutal war of aggression. And simply for making that choice, which is the correct choice under all conceivable ethical principles and interpretations of international law, he was demonized as some kind of evil killer of the good American liberators of Afghanistan.
Yeah. Anyway, it's great, Kevin, that you are so well informed on Canadian issues. You know, we toured Alberta together with you and I talking about the book. We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, the book you edited and wrote a great deal of, and I wrote an article in it.
Is great, Tony, by the way.
Well, thank you so much. We did face in Jasper, but especially in Edmonton, the Brené Brith, trying to shut down a little discussion of 30 people or so looking at a book. We did actually run into hate speech police in the audience evaluating if Kevin, if you were actually going to say something that was so outlandish that the legal system would have to come in and apprehend you. Of course, we're living in Canada right now, where Arthur Topham, he's going to go to court on October the 26th to face hate speech prosecution in Canada. And so to be able to discuss these issues sort of in a continental way, in an international way, with your audience, who I think is probably largely based in the United States, and it's a great thing, I think, to be able to bring each other up to speed on what's going on in our own countries, and because these issues that we deal with really have such transnational implications, and we really do have to think globally. And I will say that I think, Justin Trudeau, as Prime Minister of Canada, will kind of try to restore Canada's place in the international community. Stephen Harper has really taken Canada down quickly and drastically in the estimation of the global community. I mean, for instance, we were nominated to go on to our turn on the Security Council, but we didn't get on because, Canada's reputation has become so smeared. We're associated with the worst kind of neocon, ultra-Zionist, complete contempt for the international rule of law, under Harper.
But of course, you're also remarkable for all of the 9/11 truth speakers and researchers like yourself. The per capita, Canada has more 9/11 truth seekers in the academy, for instance, than the U.S. does.
I think that would be fair comment, and I'm proud to point out that I actually do work in a university. I'm not retired. That I'm teaching about these subjects actively and incorporating them in the curriculum. Among our great academic minds on the 9/11 issue and all the related issues, Graham McQueen has come out with a report on the Ottawa shooter episode, what we're calling 1022 here in Canada, an episode where a person called Michael Zahoff Bebo is reputed to have killed a Nathan Cirillo at the War Cenotaph and then charged into the parliament and then was killed in the parliament by the sergeant-in-arms, Kevin Vicker, who then was immediately taken to Israel to be given a medal by Netanyahu. It's almost an unbelievable scenario.
Yeah, you can't make
scenario.
This stuff up, right? They told this, according to the official story, this heroic officer, he's actually a pretty old guy, I think, isn't he? Like, retirement age, if not past there.
Yeah, supposedly, former RCMP, former military. And
Right. He does these amazing heroics, kind of a Superman-style physical stunt to save the save Canada from this terrorist. And then the next day he's in Tel Aviv getting a medal from Netanyahu.
And this is like the first day of Parliament, and of course all the anti-terrorist laws were being lined up, and the whole agenda was being lined up, so that the timing was just totally fortuitous to bring in a whole parliamentary agenda and then create the basis for this bill, C-51, create the basis for Lyndon Crosby to come into Canada from Australia and run this campaign, you know, based on fear of kneecaps, the Barbaric Cultural Practices Act, you know, this I'm your man to fight jihadism, you know, and Canada, you know, running as if this was a wartime election, and Harper was, you know, the wartime heroic leader that should be renewed, you know, in an emergency situation. It was trying to kind of redo the Bush campaign of 2004. So, you know, I'm proud of my country. I'm proud of Canadians that we did say no to this, and no to it in a big way. Like, there was not much expectation for a long time. It was, you know, would Mulcair win? Would Trudeau win? You know, who would be the alternative? Would the opposition simply be split and create the opportunity for Harper to get back in?
Yeah, you were honestly worried about that when we were discussing this summer.
Yeah. So in fact, Trudeau did. Regardless of policies and, you know, his support of the reprehensible Bill C-51, which many people thought was sort of unforgivable, in a dramatic way, he really found his voice. You know, he's an incredibly charming and handsome and debonair sort of fellow. And, you know, he is a kind of dynastic figure for Canadians.
Like he's almost like a Canadian Kennedy, isn't he? Because his father, Pierre Trudeau, was this very charismatic and very independent-minded kind of leader. And at that time, Canada was a haven for American Vietnam draft resistors. You could go to Cuba through Canada. It was actually different from the USA and better, you know? And so it seems like the Trudeau name is linked with that sort of. It's like the Kennedy name here, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, Trudeau was a very, you know, there was something called Trudeau Mania in 1968 when he was running and then got office. He's, you know, an unorthodox person to become a Prime Minister of Canada. He was kind of problematic in Quebec because he was an opponent of Quebec independence, which is very popular, you know, a sort of sense of self-determination for French-speaking Quebecers. This is a very important movement in Quebec, and it tends to be, you know, a left-leaning kind of socialist movement. So Trudeau Senior, Pierre Trudeau, he came to prominence, you know, opposing Quebec independence, opposing Quebec separatism. And so he was kind of problematic in Quebec, in Montreal, but in Toronto, they really loved him. They embraced him. You know, he was a bachelor, and he was very handsome, and he dated Barbara Streisand, and he was, you know, his own person. He was a rich guy like Kennedy, and he couldn't easily be bought. He just said, we're having good relations with Cuba. Like, he, you know, at the peak of the Cold War, when Cuba was to be the pariah, you know, Pierre Trudeau and Fidel Castro got along very well. They shared the same Jesuit professor from their schooling days. And, you know, so Trudeau would sort of hang out in Cuba. And we could, we never did break diplomatic relations with Cuba. And I've been to Cuba four times and, you know, been able to see that very interesting revolutionary society that Cuba became, and it was kind of a paradise for Canadians. You couldn't go there from the United States. Anyway, Trudeau was very early in relations with the Chinese, with the, you know, Marxist Chinese. He was his own person, and Toronto was really his city. So when I saw Justin Trudeau on September 28th take the podium in the election campaign, the debate hosted by this really reprehensible gold company, Barrick Gold, whose chief operator, Peter Munk, the forum was called the Munk Debates, and I wrote about it. It was a very kind of evil that Canadian Gold Company sort of besmirching Canada's name around the world with its terrible operations, a gold company that should have been the subject of debate in this leaders' debate on foreign policy, that instead they were the host of the debate and therefore, you know, finessing the questions and engineering the whole event. But nevertheless, on this podium, September the 28th, Justin Trudeau faces Stephen Harper, Tom Mulcair, and he blew them away. I mean, he just found his voice at the first of this long 11-week campaign. He was kind of awkward. But, and you know, he found his voice, and he was going for broke. And he did embody, you know, a kind of youthfulness and ability to think outside the box. And Stephen Harper and Tom Mulcair just looked like sort of fuddy-duddies, you know, trapped in their old paradigms. And from that point forward, there was no looking back. And the next thing I know, there he's saying, you know, we've got to combat this fear, this exploitation of fear of terrorism. So let's take him up on that. Let's take him up on that and say, yes, you're right. That was a very good thing to say. But how is this fear of terrorism, how has this been engineered since 9/11? And what is 9/11? Well, you know, what does the evidence show? We can't just continue to pretend that there's some kind of consensus about what 9/11 is. At the very least, there has to be an acknowledgement at the highest levels that 9/11 is contested, that there are you know, different interpretations about what really happened, and the existing prevalent interpretation is not backed up by evidence, runs contrary to any intelligent, systematic, thoughtful, methodical way of looking at the evidence.
But wait a minute, Tony. I didn't even go that far when I was teaching that class back in 2006 at the University of Wisconsin, the 16-week Islam class with 1 week that was dedicated to the different notable interpretations of the so-called war on terror. And one of them was the Muslim majority interpretation that it was an inside job. But then there was the neocon interpretation, the realist interpretation, and so on. And I wasn't going to be emphasizing any of them. But that was enough to get me hounded out of the university and put an end to my employability in American academia.
Yeah.
So what you're asking for is something that, at least here in the U.S., is quite explosive. And it's, you know, would Canada be the kind of place where people would have the courage to take this up?
Well, Canada's been a kind of place that gave a governing mandate to Stephen Harper for the last 9 years. And Canada has become a pretty dark place under the kind of draconian authority of the, you know, Darth Vader-like figure, Stephen Harper. But, you know, that was yesterday. This is today. The fact that that you had your experience in the academy in the United States, I came along much later, and you were one of those who really helped me in the early stages and actually put me on some kind of public venue, actually this radio show, which was then created the basis for me to speak in Edmonton for the first time on 9/11. And I still have my job. And I'm still, I'm going to see my students tomorrow, and we'll talk about all these things. And so I think, you know, one would hope that there is in Canada enough of a semblance of decent evidence-based, you know, reasonable thinking, conscientious citizenry that we have to go back to this issue. How did it get that far that we had a national election campaign in 2015 where the governing party used Islamophobia, used, you know, the contamination in people's minds to hate Muslims? We're actually trying to exploit this to win votes, to get back into office. I mean, this is now a historic episode, and this is day one of a different type of Canada. Because it really will be a different kind of Canada with Justin Trudeau as the chief person, as the sort of emblem of our country. And he will be seen as an emblem of our country. He's incredibly attractive. He's a very likable guy. And he's smart. He's not like Pierre Trudeau was kind of seen as a kind of wizard level smart. He's not really that way. And he, you know, he has sort of the royal jelly. You know, he is our hope. He is an embodiment of some of the better heritages of Canada. And so let's see if we can finesse the situation. And I'm asking for some help on this. You know, help in Canada, help from outside Canada. That we have an opportunity, I think, to revisit this trajectory in history that allowed things to get so bad that even here in Canada, we were drawn that deep into the, you know, cesspool, into the quagmire of using, you know, the hatred of one group towards another, of using this concocted imagery of Islamic terrorism to edify governments, to feed whole systems of industrial process, you know, the military-industrial complex. It became that bad, and how are we going to dig our way out of this? There has to be some investigation, and there has to be some reckoning with the evidence and what is concocted. You know, we have that book by Aronson, which is kind of mainstream.
Trevor Aronson. Terror Factor.
Trevor
right.
Aronson.
Yeah.
Yeah, so little by little, it's creeping into the mainstream that something is really amiss with the way this terrorism imagery has been concocted and manipulated and used by the police agencies like the FBI, like CSIS here in Canada, used to up their budgets, increase their powers, promote the surveillance state into, you know, all our, into all our areas that we formerly viewed as our private realms. You know, all of these issues are fueled by this failure, ultimately, to come to terms with what really happened on 9/11.
You know, and another step towards mainstreaming some of this stuff, Tony, is just a few days ago, the New York Times published a piece on Seymour Hersh and his revisionism about what supposedly happened to bin Laden. You know, the bin Laden killing story, which Hersh wrote was a complete crock of BS. And then he proposed an alternative based on what he was hearing from a couple of highly placed national security sources. But this New York Times piece is actually not bad for a New York Times piece. And it even quotes Hersh as being skeptical of his own version and, you know, say, yeah, they could be lying about that too. Basically, it's portraying Hersh as being quite realistic about the fact that we are being lied to in these extreme, grotesque, and monstrous ways. And that's just the way it works now. And you'd better get used to it. And if you're a journalist, you better do your job and expose the lies.
Yeah. Yeah. And so something is afoot here. I mean, the New York Times, you know, there seems to be the odd, pretty good thing in the New York Times these days. Like, for instance, an article about Harper and his campaign called The Closing of the Canadian Mind. And I took this as a very significant piece. Was it Marché? Stephen Marché wrote this New York Times piece. He's a Canadian. You recall that there was a book by Alan Bloom, The Closing of the American Mind.
Right.
This was a kind of announcement. This was part of the sort of Straussian neocon ascendancy, saying that we're going to get beyond curriculum, including, you know, lots of attention to Native people or the oppression of women or the genocide of this group or that group, and giving voice to, you know, different say Latin American voices, you know, freedom fighters in Latin America. We're going to go back to the classics, and we're going to emphasize, you know, the great works of Western civilization, and we're going to celebrate, you know, our heritage as the kind of dominant, most enlightened civilization, Western civilization. We're going to put this in our curricula. And so I saw, you know, this article, The Closing of the Canadian Mind, as a response to Alan Bloom's book. And it was sort of saying, where did it lead us, this ascendancy of neocon? Well, it led us into the darkness, into the ignorance of the Stephen Harper regime. I mean, he attacked scientists. He tried to shut up government employees, you know, who are scientists. He burned libraries. He closed off the census. We have to do a census, so you know we have some basis of knowing who our population is, how they are, how they're constructed, how their families are constructed. He did away with that, you know, and seemingly any sort of truth-based type of database, they don't want that available to the public. They want to be able to make up the narrative as they see fit, and don't want to be, you know, pulled confused by, you know, the objective reporting of reality.
We're an empire now. We create our own reality. And while you guys in the reality-based community, you know, just sit there studying what we do judiciously, as you will, we will be light years ahead of you, inventing new realities, and that's how history is going to play out from now on, right? Karl Rove to Ron Suskin.
Yeah, and you know, and we will promote amnesia because we really don't like people, you know, remembering, for instance. Where did the wealth of America come from? Well, maybe it had something to do with slavery, and maybe the stealing of resources from indigenous peoples has some continuing impact on the way, you know, our political economy is structured, and who has wealth and who doesn't, and who's at the top and who's at the bottom. You know, maybe history has something to do with these things, and maybe we have to revisit some of these processes in history. No, let's promote amnesia. Let's see that education is dumbed down. Let's see that television is dumbed down. Let's see that our newspapers are dumbed down. Let's try to get the population, in a way that they can be manipulated. Maybe fluoride in the water. Let's see that there's lots of drugs for depression and, the pharmacology, the pharmacy industry, you know, becomes hugely rich and powerful. Let's get control of the food supply.
That's right. Yeah. GMO foods. I mean, Harper was all totally with the masters of the USA on that one.
Yeah, with Monsanto and such. So it was a really, really dark regime, and it was really like it's all about the corporations and people. The more you can disempower people, the more you can keep people in the dark, the more you can isolate and, you know, narrow the group of people who actually have a say in governance. That's the neoliberal neocon agenda. And Trudeau had to, in order to get where he is today, he had to make his peace with, you know, some of these dark forces and these lobbies, and he will... he will be subject to the same forces that surrounded Obama and sort of kept Obama contained in a sense. But let's also remember, Kevin Barrett, that one thing Obama can take some credit for is stopping an outright invasion of Iran.
That's true. What a disaster that would be. I mean, you know, for everybody, a lot of Iranians would suffer, but I think they would actually hold out strategically. It would be, in some ways, a worse political disaster for the empire than for anyone else. So everybody should be happy that that hasn't happened, including the pro-empire people.
Yeah, and he's only the president of the United States. Like, presidents, how much power do presidents
have? Oh, come on, they're in middle management at least, Tony.
Yeah, and Harper was, you know, only middle management when it came to, you know, ruling Canada. Who was really, who's above Obama, and who's above Harper? And, Netanyahu does seem to be a bit, he has people pulling his strings, but he does seem to be kind of in a different category. He's been around so long.
He seems to be plugged into the kind of the deep state crime networks. And those, when you think about those networks, like if you were really going to go after the false flaggers, like the folks who pulled off the Ottawa deception, who are probably tied in with the people who've pulled off a lot of these other big false flags around the world, possibly including 9/11, you go after those people, the elite, the creme de la creme of the world's false flag operators, black op specialists, people who probably command millions of dollars for each operation that they work on. You go after those people, and, you know, your life expectancy drops a little bit. You know, somebody like Obama, or maybe in this case Trudeau, as they come into office, they might be saying the kind of thing that LBJ once supposedly said about a very efficacious opposition guy who'd been, you know, really giving LBJ a hard time. And so then LBJ appoints him to something in the cabinet, and they say, well, wait, I thought he was your enemy. And he says, well, I'd rather have him, you know, inside of the tent pissing out than outside of the tent pissing in. And somebody like Obama or Trudeau might feel the same way about these killers, these really, really proficient, highly trained killers. I mean, I can understand why you would be hesitant to take them on.
Yeah, and of course, putting people in office who have something to hide, who can be blackmailed, and of course, there's different theories that, you know, some of these sex rings, pedophilia things are, you know, are designed to compromise people and make them more easy to manipulate by, you know, but by threatening, by blackmailing people. So, you know, but I did, before leaving the subject, I do want to get back to the, you know, Obama, with all our criticisms of him, he's only got so much political capital, and he chose to invest a lot of that political capital into, you know, trying to normalize relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And it was a sensible thing for him to do in terms of, you know, the true American national interest, because Iran is so important in Eurasia and such. But he did that. And, you know, and because he did that, you know, very dear friends of you and I, when we've been to that beautiful country, you know, are alive today. And you know, the gardens are growing in Iran, and the beautiful environment of that place is, you know, and the roots of our civilization, you know, the Persian roots of Western civilization are more or less intact there. So I think it's important to, you know, put that out there, that yes, Obama disappointed it in so many ways, but when it came to deciding how to use whatever little, you know, political capital, because, you know, you're so controlled and manipulated at that level to get that high in office, you have to make so many deals, cut so many deals, that how much do you have left of your own political capital? I think that might be something, you know, interesting about Trudeau, because he is Justin Trudeau. He is the oldest son of Pierre Elliott Trudeau, you know, who some see as one of the greatest Canadian prime ministers ever. And so, you know, a lot of his political capital, Justin, you know, he will owe people to get where he got, and he will have to have made deals with, you know, some of the diabolical forces of our, you know, military-industrial complex and all of that. But he is Justin Trudeau, and it's possible that he, over time, will be able to develop, you know, more available political capital when you put a poor person like Obama or Nixon in power, I mean, they're poor. They've had to make so many deals to get into place. But when you put somebody like John F. Kennedy in power, well, you know, they have wealth. It's more difficult to buy them off. So there is a kind of, you know, perhaps this sort of certain types of aristocrats actually do have more possibility of having some degree of independence.
Some people think that's true of Donald Trump, not just Trudeau, but also Trump.
Well, Donald Trump.
Both their names start with TRU.
He's more free to, like, really take the...
He's causing a big stink, Tony, about 9/11. I don't know if you've been following our news here south of the border.
Oh, right, yeah.
He's blaming Bush for 9/11, and the Republican neocons are going crazy. They're tearing their hair out. This horrible Trump, how irresponsible. He's saying that, you know, 9/11 happened on Bush's watch, and he's implying that Bush is responsible for 9/11. He's almost a truther.
Yeah. Of course, you know, Bush is, you know, obviously secondary to Cheney. Bush was not the hands-on guy.
Yeah, well, that's what Trump should say. He should say, Jeb, I'm really sorry to have blamed your brother for 9/11. We know that he was out of the loop. It was all Cheney. And somehow
yeah,
I don't expect that.
I think, you know, when we looked at, in spite of, you know, Obama's abuses of power, and, you know, when we looked from the perspective of Canada, with our governance being centered on Stephen Harper, when we looked to the South with the governance being centered on Obama, it was still a better situation. But now it's kind of reversed again, where I think Canada's in a better situation. When I look at the politics coming up to your election in 2016 in the United States, there's not, I guess Bernie Sanders is sort of a bright light. But,
oh, yeah.
I mean,
he's one of my favorite Zionists.
Yeah, I mean, he's good on the domestic issues, but he's, you know, he's caught up in that network, in that neocon Zionist network.
And, of course, the conventional wisdom is he can't win.
What's that?
The conventional wisdom is that he cannot possibly win.
Yeah. So it's, you know, how is Hillary, who's going to beat Hillary Clinton? And so she's going to continue the same old in so many ways. And then, you know, the right-wing Republican field is kind of, wow, you know, it's just how low can you go? How weird can you get?
No kidding, man. Some of these people make Harper look pretty moderate and thoughtful. And, you know, frankly, Tony, I'm really glad that Harper's gone, because in the past however many years, you know, I always have to think, well, if they pull the next big false flag and they're ready to set up death camps for Muslims, especially truther Muslims, I guess I would be the first one to the new gas chambers. And so where would I go? Well, I'm here in Wisconsin, just a few hundred miles from the Canadian border. But if I tried to flee to Harper's Canada, I would be going from the proverbial frying pan into the fire. But now that he's gone and Trudeau's in there, frankly, I would have a slight chance, perhaps, of thinking that things might be better on the other side of the border if they're, you know, if they're building like death camps in America for people like me, and I might still try to slip through the woods up there. You know, maybe this is all just fantasy. I don't know.
Well, of course, you know, there you are in Wisconsin, and you'll notice as you drive down the road that you'll see a lot of French Canadian names and a lot of Aboriginal
everywhere.
Names
Eau Claire, La Crosse.
Yes. Yeah, so yeah, yeah. Actually, you know, you're living in Canada, really, Kevin. And,
I know. I know.
You know,
this is occupied
it's
Canada.
It's occupied by the United States, but yeah. You know, those of us who are true patriot lovers of Canada, we know that you're really living in Canada, and really we consider you a Canadian citizen.
Well, you know, I would love to lead an independence revolution here in Wisconsin and break off and become a sort of a buffer state between Canada and the U.S. where we could actually be independent. That would be pretty cool.
And that would play upon an existing motif in history where that region was going to be Indiana, a buffer state between the United States and the British Empire, British Imperial Canada. It would probably be called Indiana, and it would be a polity where the Aboriginal governments would be preeminent, or would set the tone, the prevalent motif. It would be, you know, backed by the British Empire. It would be, you know, this buffer state idea was you know, a serious possibility through a period of North American history. And of course, you know, this gets me into being able to talk about the fact that, you know, I see this global war on terror as, you know, very much a continuation of the kind of Indian wars and the whole discourse of, you know, civilization and savagery, and, you know, this justification for the westward expansion of the United States, especially as an imperative of the civilized people, of the Christian people, to take over from the savage people and to, you know, make the world safer and better, having a manifest destiny, having an actual charter from God to carry this out as God's chosen people, and really stressing this Old Testament view of the world. You know, that has been renewed since 9/11 in the global war on terror, and this idea of Islamic terrorism, these savages who are trying to destroy us and hate our freedoms and represent, you know, a lower order of human consciousness and
well, that's what Pam Geller says.
Human at all.
And those bus ads. The Pam Geller's been plastering all the big American cities with bus ads, saying, "In the war between the civilized man and the savage, always support the civilized man." And then the subtext, which isn't spoken, is, "So kill all the Palestinians. They're just savages."
Yes.
Yeah.
And while you're at it, maybe don't just limit yourself to Palestinians. Maybe all the Arabs. And aren't the Arabs primarily Muslim? And so maybe let's even expand it past the Arab world to the Muslim world.
And, right. And now so suddenly I find myself on the list as one of her savages. Wait a minute. I thought I was just a normal, you know, white Midwestern guy.
Yes. So, seeing this in historical context and seeing this last election campaign and Harper's effort, I mean, he actually used the language of savagery and civilization. He kept coming up with the phrase that, you know, our mandate is to keep savagery away from our shores, you know, from our benevolent Canadian civilization.
Hey, I saw some of these TV commercials, Tony, while we were touring in Canada, like in the motel TV. It was way over the top.
Yes. Oh, that was such a great time, Kevin, with your family. And we really got lots of chance to talk about many subjects. And that's really where it came clear to me that this wrong interpretation of 9/11 and all that followed, this does amount to hate speech. The dissemination of this official conspiracy theory about 9/11, the Osama bin Laden, 19 Saudis with box cutters, this whole concocted fable, this is hate speech. And it was intended, this was the deeper intention of the whole operation, to create the basis, to continue the military-industrial complex, to create a new enemy to replace the old Soviet enemy, to make an enemy that could be, you know, domestic and international and global and local, and lone wolf terrorism and homegrown terrorism, and, you know, jihadist terrorism. It's just become overdone. It's so exaggerated, so amplified, it's so crazy that even Seymour Hersh is noticing it. Who else is going to notice it? I mean, I keep hearing now criticism of the niqab debate in Canada, but, you know, there's an elephant in the room, you know, and the bigger elephant is, this wasn't just about, you know, wearing masks at a citizen ceremony in Canada. This was about building up an imagery in people's minds, an imagery directing them to be suspicious and antagonistic towards Arab people, towards Muslim people, towards brown-skinned people. I mean, in the worst kind of wedge politics, these neocons made mastery of wedge politics and the sort of highest, most diabolical level of wedge politics is using religion. And okay, let's make it all about, oh, it's the Shia versus the Sunni, and it's, you know, the this and the that. Like, keep trying to find wedges, religious wedges. This, you know, phenomenon of Christian Zionism, and, you know, waiting for the rapture, and all of this, you know, this enormously successful big business churches that have been tied to this whole structure that, you know, that Harper, you know, this was part of his strategy to take over from the Republican Party, how to use religion and how to use the churches. You know, it was very clear in Alberta, which did not go along with the backing Justin Trudeau. It's very clear in Alberta that the resistance and, you know, the majority of seats here in Alberta did go to the Conservatives, did go to Harper. And the base of that organization, that political organization, is Christian Zionism. And, you know, what an assault on the decent heritage of Christianity. And,
you know, that's a
social
perfect place to leave it here, Tony. Because, you know, my next show is actually an interview with Mark Siljander, the former Republican congressman from Michigan, who was an arch Islamophobe. and then discovered that Islam and Christianity have so much in common, and he's been a peacemaker ever since. So that's going to be the next episode. And we've hit the end of the hour, but this has been a fantastic conversation. Tony Hall, you are the guy to talk to about Canadian politics in general and the fall of the Harper regime in particular. So congratulations to you and the other brave Canadian patriots who helped bring down this tyrant and set a kind of example that the rest of us in the Western world should be following.
And are we live on the radio right now?
No, this is pre-recorded, but we're at the end of the hour, so...
And when can I hear it, or where will I?
Okay, I'll do a quick commercial. This is Truth Jihad Radio, and everybody can find Truth Jihad Radio by going to truthjihad.com. Click on the radio link, and that will take you to the radio blog, and then you can find the archive where it'll be posted forever. It'll also tell you when it will be broadcast. This show will be broadcast on Wednesday, October 21st, at 10 a.m. Central, which is 11 a.m. Eastern and 8 a.m. Pacific. And we do have four shows, five guests per week here at Truth Jihad Radio. Well, thank you so much, Tony Hall. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Yeah, well, I got about 10 minutes notice, but I was really wanting to say a few things about this election. Thanks for giving me that opportunity, Kevin.
Okay, thanks, Tony. Great job. Bye. And congratulations again. Bye-bye.
Bye.